So a couple of announcement-like things in a way. A couple of questions about, having looked at the talks on Audio Dharma and seeing that I've got, somebody said I've got 1,402 talks, 1,403 talks on Audio Dharma. Where do I start? And somebody else said, looking at your past Audio Dharma talks, can I assume they'll be in the Saito Utejaniya approach? I'd say that in the last 4 or 5 years, maybe even a little longer than that, my teachings is very influenced by Saito Utejaniya. But in terms of the practice of talking about the style of practice, many of the talks I give are looking at particular teachings from the Buddha and talking about how we can see those in our lives. So, I've given right now I'm going through a series on the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path as a way to kind of just explore pretty much all the teachings of the Buddha. I've said that all of his teachings can be found in those teachings. So I'm just exploring, walking through these various teachings. And so it's not so much instructional in terms of how to do this practice. And yet, when I speak about how to see these things in our experience, it's very influenced by my practice in this style. So, it depends on what your interest is. If the interest is in the instructions of this style and kind of guidance on practicing in this style, I think the best thing I could recommend is I've taught a number of retreats in this style. And I put links to about the last 4 years of retreats in this style that I've taught at IRC on the Google Doc page. So those are pretty easy to access. It's like this one, certain parts of that retreat are kept for retreatants only, but there's a lot in there that's available for the public. So those kind of walk through the instructions, and then also we'll bring in, often in those retreats, I weave through a particular teaching of the Buddha. Like one retreat, conditionality was the teaching I wove through. Another was the five aggregates. So there'll be a kind of a combination of the instructions and a teaching from the Buddha that come into those retreats. So I put those links on the website so that you can find those if that's of interest. And then the question that seems the most relevant at this point is kind of a question around transitioning. There was a question around, okay, we've been in retreat. This has been so helpful. Someone saying, I've noticed a clinging for this retreat, for the feeling I don't want this to end. Can you talk about how to transition from the retreat to practicing on my own? Any experience of transition you can share would be helpful. And then also a question or a comment about appreciating this morning's discussion, but hoping that we kind of looped back to daily life and incorporating simple awareness into daily activities. The emphasis on simple awareness. How do we bring that to our daily lives? So those are two pieces that I wanted to just reflect on a little bit, and then open it up for comments or questions. So, in terms of a transition out of retreat, full disclosure here, I have never attended a daily life retreat myself. I've only ever taught them. And yet, I do know from working with many people on these retreats that there is a transition out of these retreats. The structure that we create here. I mean, you're in your lives, and this is a good pointing to the transition, how the transition can work. How you engage between the sessions shows you the possibility. It shows you the possibility of how to meet your experience. And that said, the structure of the retreat, the fact that we meet every, you know, a couple times a day, especially this group, you know, you're showing up. I think most of you are showing up both times. Some of you maybe can't make it in the morning, but you know, you've got the structure here, and part of what makes it a retreat and brings in the more of the continuity of the practice is just the daily regular dose of Dharma that you're getting here. You know, quite a bit of Dharma, quite a bit of orienting to the practice of just noticing awareness and being with your experience and curiosity about what's happening. You're getting a lot of that in a couple times a day. You're getting that. And so that begins to shape the mind. It shapes the mind. And when this goes away, the structure of this retreat goes away, you will notice it. You will notice that it gets harder. It is, you know, one of the sad things about retreats, you know, the structure, the form of the retreat does create conditions that makes it easier to practice. And these retreats, this retreat, a little bit less structure in some ways than some of the online retreats that we've been doing, and more of an encouragement to practice in your daily lives. But at the same time, what I have been hearing, another full disclosure, I've never sat an online retreat myself either. I've only ever taught them. What I understand from a lot of folks is that the practicing in your home environment with the retreat container, the infusion of that into your space is very powerful. And so, you know, you might have noticed some of that, and you may recognize that even with the absence of the container, the practice that you've been doing in your home has been infusing the Dharma into your environment. So that can help, you know, all the places you've practiced. I find when I walk onto the Spirit Rock land, or I arrive at IMS, it's like there's a memory of all of the retreats I've done there, and it just supports a mindfulness when I arrive there. When I've done my own retreats in my own house, I remember the very first retreat I did for a home retreat, a self-retreat, where I did it at home, and I called up my teacher and was checking in with my teacher. The very first home retreat that I did, when I finished it, it felt like my house had been kind of blessed with the Dharma. And when I walked through the house, there were memories of practicing in the house. And that supported me. That supported me to remember mindfulness. So there are some supports that we have, but at the same time, there are a lot of supports that are going away. So I'll point to a couple of key things that for myself, I have found really helpful in terms of practicing in daily life. And the first one is one of the earliest things I said. Notice what it's like to notice awareness returning. You've gotten much more familiar with that this week. It may drop off a little bit when the container goes away, but you'll still notice awareness returning. So some of the practice when we leave a retreat, I mean, essentially maybe what we could say is that the practice container is a support for the intention to practice. And when we lose the container, we have to draw that intention up for ourselves. So for myself, that kind of connecting regularly with that intention, I want to remember to be aware. For stretches of time in my practice, I put reminders all over my house. I used a particular list that the Buddha pointed to, the paramis, and that was a help to me. You know, I put generosity on the door as I was leaving the house, just remembering, okay, you know, the little sticky helped me remember to kind of bring my sense of awareness and maybe infuse it with some generosity. I put a sticky on the phone that said truthfulness, on the computer that said equanimity, on the refrigerator that said wisdom. You know, just little notes around that kind of helped me to remember. So using things like that, you know, find creative ways to help you remember your intention. And two, it can be helpful to just kind of use the reflection practices. Reflect a couple times a week, maybe even each day, about how the practice supported you and where mindfulness got lost. And then seeing if, rather than using that to beat yourself up, use it as a kind of a, oh, gee, I didn't remember, you know, a lot of the day. And in particular, I think really it got lost as soon as I went out the door and started, you know, driving around and going to the grocery store. That's where it got lost. So maybe tomorrow, maybe I could put a big sticky on my car that'll help me remember to be mindful when I'm driving, or something like that. You know, just little things to help you remember. So I'm a fan of props to help remember mindfulness in daily life. And then the other piece that I have found really useful, and in my early practice, I talked a little bit about my early practice here, you know, the early practice around working with anger. That was my first meditation object, really. My first practice was around working with anger. And I was not interested in meditating at all. But I was interested in understanding my mind. And so a friend had sent me a book, the book Everyday Zen by Joko Beck. And I read that book and didn't understand about three quarters of it, but got a little bit from it. And you know, the main thing I got was, you know, try being aware when something hard is happening, you know, when the mind is reacting rather than being involved in it, just try to know it. And so that's what I began doing in my daily life. I set this intention. I set an intention. I'm going to notice every time I'm angry. Well, with anger, actually, I probably did at the beginning anyway, because it was so obvious. You know, it's like, the anger wouldn't stop until at some point mindfulness broke in. And then it was like, oh yeah, I said I would be aware of this. Oh, this is so painful. What do I do about this? I don't know. I guess I go back to work. You know, just enough mindfulness in that moment to kind of take in the experience. And so a lot, you know, I think one of the reasons I love teaching daily life practices, because it was my first practice, the first 2, 3 months of my practice were entirely looking at my mind in daily life, looking at the anger, noticing when it happened. I also picked a kind of routine, mundane, everyday thing, you know, switching between DOS and Windows on my computer. And I said, I'm going to wake up for that too. So I picked a couple of projects to kind of orient to, can I know when these things happen? And it wasn't perfect by any means, but over time, you know, just the intention, connecting to the intention, I'm going to be aware when these things happen. And then noticing at the end of the day, yeah, I know I switched between DOS and Windows a lot today because that's what I do all day long. Yes, this is like 25 years ago. You know, something, it was a long time ago. You know, so I know that I did that a lot today because that's part of my job. I do it, and I remembered it maybe twice. Okay, that's okay. I'll just try again. You know, so that attitude really served me. I'm just going to try again. And with the anger, you know, the anger, what spurred that, what spurred the work there was the curiosity. I was really motivated to understand it because it was so painful. It was so affecting my life. And so picking something that you are really interested in understanding about how your mind engages in the world, habits or patterns that are frequent for you, You don't have to, I mean, you can in a daily life. In this practice, in this retreat, we've been exploring the cultivation of the awareness itself, and the practice of noticing the awareness returning is a part of that. But at times it can also be useful in daily life to kind of notice those areas we get caught. So noticing the places where the mindfulness gets lost, those areas where we get caught, places where there's a lot of struggle. And then you can highlight those areas a little bit. Instead of like having the idea in our mind, I'm going to try to be mindful all day long. It's more like, I want to be mindful when that happens. So that can be a support as well, to have something that you're really curious about understanding. I found with that curiosity around anger, it began to spill over. I began noticing things about loneliness and confusion and all kinds of other emotional things that I began noticing before I ever even sat down to meditate, before I learned about how to meditate. So it's possible actually to just bring this curiosity and just with a curiosity and a non-judgmental attitude of mind about what's arising, just more like, this will help you learn. I think that's what I learned from the book by Joko Beck too. This will help you learn about what's going on. And then I began to get tastes of how that learning worked. Within a few months, I think I talked about, an experience of seeing a thought arise in my mind and the mind kind of heading towards wanting to get angry at somebody. That was like in the first couple of months of my practice. And yeah, I saw that. And that was the moment that I was on board. And not long after that was when I started sitting. I started doing sitting practice because I'd always wondered about Joko Beck calling this thing practice. She kept talking about the word practice, and I thought, that's a funny word for meditating. Why are you calling it that? And then after a couple of months of looking at my mind in daily life, I began to think, huh, I wonder if what she means is like if you sit down and meditate, it's practice for being able to see your mind in daily life. If that's what it does, I'm on board for that. I'll do that. So that's why I started to meditate, so that I could see my mind better in my daily life. So it is helpful to sit. It is helpful to keep the momentum of mindfulness reminding yourself. So that's another support. And those are a few thoughts about transitioning. And yeah, the simple awareness in daily life. I really do think the again, I said this early on, I think, when I described the daily life part of the practice, that when you notice mindfulness returning, just notice what's obvious. During the week, what's obvious in that moment has probably gotten a little bit more subtle. There's maybe a little bit more there that you can actually see. That's the simple awareness. The simple awareness is just receiving what's available to be received. I think you're probably noticing that there's more available and that you're not having to do it too much. That's the simple awareness. So when you notice that mindfulness returns, receive what's here. Be available to know what's happening in that moment. You're walking across the street and awareness returns. Is there ease? Is there calm? That was a good way in for me too, is just kind of checking the basic state of mind. Is it ease or calm? What is the activity? What am I doing? Where am I going? Those kinds of things. But again, the simpler receptive piece is more just what's here to be known. If you're curious about that moment of awareness returning and what's being received in that moment, that will really begin to it'll get the momentum, it'll get some of the momentum of mindfulness rolling in daily And for myself, I've often said, if there is, if that awareness that returns, it'll have a life. It'll last for a certain length of time by of its own nature, of its own accord. It will arise and it'll have a momentum. And sometimes we can ride that momentum for a little while, and without a lot of effort in daily life. And so we can begin to get the sense of that too, the quality of just being aware with ease for a few seconds, maybe even as long as like 15 or 20 seconds, maybe. Often I find it comes in and then it just goes out. In daily life, I don't try to hold on to it unless I'm in a situation where there's not a lot of need to be engaged with a kind of an active mind. So doing chores or taking a walk, I'm kind of just keeping going. What's going on? So there's a little bit of the reminding, what's happening? What's going on right now? Recognizing the awareness and then remembering to keep recognizing it. We haven't talked much this week, and it's come up more people talking about, it's been hard. There's a lot of work thoughts coming up all week, but there has been a lot of questions about working with talking. And we talked a little bit about the 50-50 mindfulness as a way in to kind of being aware when talking, and talked a little bit about reading and writing as ways to get familiar with both giving somebody else content and taking content in, with that practice of 50-50 awareness. Those things will help to support you in being aware while talking and listening. So practicing with that, having a curiosity about being aware while talking. If you find that that's an area of a mindfulness disappears when you're talking, that's a useful place to be curious. What happens there? Working with mindful speech for me was a pretty late in the process. Many, many teachers that I've talked to, many of my colleagues, also say that it's one of the most difficult places to bring mindfulness to when there's that activity of talking. In the monastery with Sayadaw Utejaniya, he encouraged us to talk so that we could practice mindfulness of talking. And it took me a while to start doing that. I wasn't interested in really engaging in that for the first couple weeks in the monastery. But there was an event that happened at around 4 o'clock each afternoon. They served juice, and it was nice to get some juice in the middle of the afternoon. But it was like a cocktail party, Everybody got their juice and they stood there with their juice having conversations, and it was pretty much everybody in the monastery. It was kind of a hard experience for me. I wasn't too good at cocktail parties. But I decided at a certain point to play with it, to see what's going on there. And the mindfulness would get lost and be like, okay, yeah, got lost again. And then one time I was having a conversation with somebody, and it was very clear to me that they were completely present while they were talking. And that brought me into mindfulness. And it was effortless. It was a revelation. I was pretty mindful for the entire conversation without a lot of trying and doing. And that showed me, too, again, the doing of trying to be mindful while you're constructing content, while you're listening and taking in content. That's a hard thing to do. It kind of it kind of gets in the way if you're trying to be mindful. But this was an arising of a gift. It was a gift and arising of a very easeful mindfulness that didn't take much effort. It was more just like, wow, I'm mindful and I'm talking at the same time. That's pretty cool. It's working and I'm not having to do this. I'm not having to try very hard. So that gave me the flavor of what it was like. And then I began noticing that in certain conversations with certain people, I would get really, I would be aware, but I would get really tense and tight. And at some point, I talked to Sayadaw Ateshiniya about it, and I described the situation, which was I was realizing I wanted to stop talking, and I was trying to close the conversation down with the person. I would say something that I thought would like give the clue that I was done, and that person would just launch into another thing. And I didn't at that point just say, "Okay, I'm done now." That's what I should have done. I'm done now. Goodbye. But I was waiting in a way, and so this was something else I learned about myself. I was waiting for them to give me permission to leave the conversation, instead of just saying, "I'm done now." And I reported this all to Sayadaw Ateshiniya. And he said, "Well, what you're missing is noticing when agitation arises in the mind when you're talking." And so that began to be a really simple, oh, I forgot to turn my ringer off. We'll just have to wait for a moment. Hang on a second. I'm curious, are you hearing the ringing in the background? Oh, great. Okay, then I'll just go ahead and talk through it. So I use that as a really simple tool. Like, okay, I'm mindful. I'm aware of talking. I'm aware that I'm talking. And instead of just knowing that I was talking and having content, I allowed it to come down to, is there agitation or ease while I'm talking? That was really helpful. I didn't have to try to track. I mean, because I wasn't able to track, like in that first conversation where it was a gift of showing me the possibility. I was able to know what I was going to say before I say it, and it came out, and know how I was responding to the person. All of that was very easeful. Most of the time following that, it wasn't like that. But Sayadaw's pointing to the agitation while talking helped me to recognize, okay, I don't have to try to track all of what's going on. If I can just be with myself while I'm having a conversation, know that I'm talking, and then know that whether there's agitation or calm, that was a really helpful way into mindfulness while speaking and listening and having a conversation. So bringing curiosity to being mindful while talking is a really powerful mindfulness practice in our daily lives. Sayadaw Ujjayini said that when he created an intention for himself, we take the precepts to guide our ethical conduct, and we take the precept around speech, the usual precept around speech to refrain from false speech. Sayadaw Ujjayini said he added the intention to include the other three aspects of wise speech: refraining from harsh speech, refraining from divisive speech, refraining from idle chatter, and refraining from false speech, those four. And he said when he created that intention in his mind for part of his daily practice, he like added those to his precepts. He said, that's when my mindfulness really started zooming in my daily life. That was a very powerful doorway in for him. That was more about transition than I thought I had in there. I'll break the recording now.